Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The Simpson Collection at the National Gallery of Art is one of the few remaining private collections assembled with the participation of artist Auguste Rodin, 1840 to 1917. The centenary of Rodin's death offers an occasion to examine the large number of works that Catherine Saney Simpson and John W. Simpson, the first American collectors to meet Rodin, gave to the gallery in 1942. In this lecture, recorded on May 5, 2017, Antoinette Lenormand-Romain provides an overview of the Simpson collection of drawings and sculptures in bronze, marble, terracotta, and plaster, including Rodin's portrait of Mrs. Simpson. The gallery has benefited since from the generosity of other donors, helping to build, as Yale University art historian Charles Seymour Jr. stated, a first-rate collection of works by Rodin.
Since 1917 is the centenary of Rodin's death, it is the perfect moment to honor Kate Saney Simpson, thanks to whom the National Gallery of Art can exhibit the best collection alongside the Metropolitan Museum of Art One. And I want to thank Elizabeth Cropper and the deans at CASVA, and also Ali Peel and Sarah Battle, and also, of course, CD, for giving me this opportunity to do it. During the summer of 1902, Kate Simpson sat for Rodin. It was quite a daring decision. Indeed, at that date, Rodin was still little known in the United States. The three marbles exhibited at the World Columbian Exhibition in Chicago in 1893 were deemed very erotic, and they were quickly hidden away in a special exhibition room in Chicago. Charles Yerkes of Chicago, who had just acquired the admirable Orpheus and Eurydice, at this point commissioned the second marble, Cupid and Psyche, to register his support for the artist. Rodin was equally admired by Arthur Jerome Eddy, who was a young art historian in Chicago and who commissioned his bust in 1898 and gave a lecture on the artist the following year at the Art Institute. Of course, it seems unlikely that Kate Simpson would have seen these sculptures, but she likely knew the St. John the Baptist bust, which Samuel Avery had given the Metropolitan Museum of Art on the same time. Indeed, Avery had been the advisor of her father when this one built his collection. Kate had been brought up in New York with her five sisters and three brothers, and she belonged to this cultivated high society milieu, which was at the origin of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. In 1887, her father, George Saney, who was a financier, a philanthropist, and a collector, had given the Met important contemporary paintings, among this one. 2 years later, Kate married a successful corporate lawyer who had created his own firm in New York, John Woodruff Simpson, from a Vermont family. He was not in the habit of collecting, but as time passed, he also became a connoisseur and collector of 18th century French and English paintings. 10 years after their marriage, they had a fine mansion built on Fifth Avenue in New York by the architect Gilbert, and it was Kate's residence until the beginning of the 1940s. The Simpsons used to travel to Europe. Of course, when they were in France, they visited the Musée du Luxembourg, the museum which hosted contemporary works of art. Quite a lot of sculptures by Rodin were on view, among which Mrs. Vicuña marble bust. This bust had been very admired when exhibited in 1888, and indeed so much admired that the French state decided to acquire it from the model, the young and elegant wife of a Chilean diplomat. This attractive image in the 18th century style, which collectors enjoyed a lot, is very special in Rodin's work in the 80s. Indeed, at that time, the portraits he did were almost only portraits of friends and famous men, such as Victor Hugo, to help his career, or of women who were very close to him, Rose Beret, his lifelong companion, or Camille Claudel, with whom he was madly in love. It is likely Madame Vicuña's bust which gave the Simpsons the idea of having Kate's portrait done by Rodin. The cynic's interest for contemporary artists on one side, John Simpson's love for 18th century on the other, helped John and Kate to decide on Rodin, though they had not yet met him. And it was probably Samuel Bing, the owner of the famous Art Nouveau Gallery in Paris and of a shop in New York, who introduced them to Rodin. We know, thanks to a receipt preserved in the Rodin archives, that he was given a fee of 5,000 francs by Rodin for bringing him these new clients, and 5,000 francs is a sum which corresponded to the fifth of the total price of the bust. So it's a very large sum. The making of the bust was the beginning of a deep and lasting friendship. We can follow it in the correspondence, which is mainly from Kate's hand, even if it is obvious that her husband acted his part in this relationship, which lasted until 1917, the year of Rodin's death. And I'm going to give you some extracts of the letters, which are most of them in Musée Rodin's archive, so you can hear Kate's voice. Kate sat for Rodin at the end of the summer of 1902. And later she reminisced that she sat 60 times, and it was probably during these long hours that her daughter, the young Jean, was photographed in the Dépôt des Marbres, where Rodin had his studio. She is sitting here on the large uncarved blocks, and she's playing with a pet. And Rodin also did some drawings of her, which were sold in an auction in 1982, after her death. Rodin told Kate that no model had ever consented to pose for that length of time, and that it was essential to him. And even if 60 times sounds like an exaggeration, Rodin always asked for many sitting sessions, during which sometimes the sitter fell asleep. But others remembered how it was nice and interesting to chat with him during these long hours. The dedication of the small kiss, which is here, testify on these long hours. You can read Homage to Mrs. Simpson in memory of the studio hours, September 1902. Rodin began by modeling a clay bust. Thanks to Ouida Grant, who was Little Jean's governess and an amateur photographer, we have an image of Kate sitting, bare shoulders, which Rodin always asked for because he needed to be able to study the structure of the body and the bearing of the model. In the clay modeling, Rodin captured Kate's alert and open face, the eyes looking straight at him. Almost invariably, he said to a journalist, "There is intelligence in the face of the woman of this nation. But there is furthermore kindness of heart evidenced in the countenance of this model. That is what I shall attempt to express, and it is a difficult task." The next step was to take plaster casts of the clay head, one of which he later gave Mrs. Simpson, and try them in various positions in order to decide on the one which suited her best. Then came the choice of the marble block and the carving. Looking at Mrs. Simpson's bust, we take immediately notice of the strange way Rodin had of setting the head in the block. Indeed, the face is in line with one of the corners of a triangular block, creating an impression of space and dimension exactly as in the allegorical portrait of Camille Claudel, which is called Dawn. The nature of the block was of great importance to Rodin, and he used it to stay as close as possible to the original block, with a preference for irregularly shaped blocks. In some cases, the marble actually guides the composition, as if Rodin wanted to show as much respect for the material as possible. And indeed, he didn't eschew any form. Quite the contrary, he would make use of it. Also, he never shared his thoughts on the subjects. One feels he found it stimulating. And here, we can see the surface of the marble, almost as it was when it came from the quarry, and which Rodin liked to preserve. And in Kate's bust, we can notice also this gray line, which is here, which crosses the breast and goes down in the back. Another sculptor would have thought that it was terrible and done what he could to make it disappear, whereas Rodin enjoyed it. He enjoyed it in the same way that he always enjoyed and preserved the chance happenings in studio practice, which insert sculpture into life. The bust was achieved during the summer of 1903, Rodin adding a final touch to the marble in Kate's presence. Because here, of course, we can see that it is the marble. Looking frankly at her interlocutor, Kate always had the same nice and secure bearing, but her dress is no longer the plain camisole she wore in the first version. She was a high society figure, and even if the details are not precise, except for the flowers, we feel that she has dressed up. When 15 years earlier, Madame Vicuña's portrait was the image of the socialite, here, the large expanse of the marble gives the bust an air of solidity, which reflects Kate's social status and also probably her personality. The bust was sent to New York as soon as it was completed, but before that, Rodin had a plaster cast taken of it. Maybe he intended to rework the marble. This photography here suggests what seems to be a plaster cast on which we see areas covered with a black material, which is probably plastiline, this, and which Rodin used to rework some of his sculptures. I quote, "Of the bust, it's impossible to speak with moderation," wrote a very happy John Simpson on December 1903 to Rodin. "It surpasses all expectation. I thought I appreciated it before I saw it in its place, but at every moment I discover a new beauty, a new force. It's simply overwhelming. Not only one of your masterpieces, but one of the great masterpieces of all art. I owe you an enormous debt for having given me this work, and I thank you with all my heart." We do not know Kate's opinion, but 3 years later, she inscribed on a photograph of the bust she sent to Rodin, "To Monsieur Rodin, my sculptor." As for Rodin, he also felt so pleased with the bust that he had it returned to Paris for the 1904 Salon, where it was exhibited alongside the large sinker, which was on view in Paris for the first time. A few days after the Salon opening, Rodin sat in front of the admirable tender blossoming spring, and he wrote to Mrs. Simpson, "I am happy. I have made you content with your bust, which you have judged to be very beautiful, the first, and also Monsieur Simpson, which I hope is feeling better, finds himself to be satisfied." This judgment I find both biased and charming. The judgment is ratified by the Parisian public, which finds in it a subtle grace, almost more delicate than the grace of the bust in the Luxembourg. "I gave my soul to it for all the difficulties that are encountered when working on the bust of a beautiful woman. At the same moment, René Jappel, who was a Paris art dealer and who advised John Simpson about his painting collection, sent them press cuttings confirming that The Sinker was thought to be a masterpiece which could only be compared to Michelangelo, and that the bust was in the place of honor at the Salon and very much admired. I quote, "Many people told me that it was one of the best by Rodin. I have had myself a great pleasure in meeting you again and so well represented in marble." And indeed, it led to new commissions for Rodin for portraits such as Mrs. Potter Palmer from Chicago, but also of women who belong to the higher circles of London society, like Mrs. Hunter or Lady Sackville. The bust had arrived to the Simpsons' residence in New York at the same time as The Sinker and A Small Walking Man, both of them among the first casts for the artist done by Alexis Rudier, who was to become Rodin's almost unique founder. Both of them were also the first copies of these sculptures to arrive in the United States. They were in the original size. The Sinker is in the size as designed for the gates of hell, and simultaneously, it represents Dante, Baudelaire, Hugo, all the poets whom Rodin admired, and poetry itself. And The Walking Man preserves the size of the assemblage that Rodin had done just before 1900. He had stuck together two studies. One was a study for St. John the Baptist torso, which he had rediscovered in his studio, all cracked and decayed, and which he had thought totally beautiful in that state, indeed as beautiful as an antique fragment. And the other was a study for St. John's legs. The legs were in good condition, and the contrast between the two elements didn't trouble Rodin. On the contrary, he enjoyed it and left the sculpture as it was. When the Simpsons ordered bronze copies of these two sculptures, it was again a daring decision. Of course, not for The Sinker, of which there were already about 7 copies, but for The Walking Man, or as it was titled at that time, The Study for St. John the Baptist. It had been exhibited for the first time in the personal show organized by Rodin in 1900, but nobody had taken notice of it. And indeed, it only became famous after the enlargement had been shown in the 1907 Salon. We can imagine how happy Rodin was that he knew his new clients and friends valued a statue that embodied the new direction he was pushing sculpture into, as much as the other one that was considered his most achieved work in the time of the Gates of Hell. All the Simpson casts, bronze casts, are fine ones, but maybe the most beautiful is La France, a bust which was given its title in 1912 after a low relief version had been installed on the monument celebrating the 3rd centenary of Samuel Champlain's discovery of the lake named after him. But in the beginning of the 20th century, the title was Byzantine Empress or St. George, and in fact, we recognize Camille Claudel's face under a kind of a Renaissance helmet. Rodin liked to morph his sculptures, and we have another example of the same process with the portrait of Mrs. Russell transformed into a St. George, and at this stage, not progressing beyond a plaster. Okay, here you have, Mrs. Russell, and again with a helmet. The Mrs. Russell bust progressed then to a Minerva with armor and helmet, which gave birth to a series of marbles, of which here you have two versions. when the Byzantine Empress, St. George, was cast into bronze. The casting is of high quality, exceptionally crisp, with deep hollows and even holes, as if Rodin had planted a tool into the clay when it was still wet. And perhaps you can see these holes in this part. Anne Limet, who used to do the patinas on Rodin bronzes, made a beautiful patina here with hints of blue and green. The Simpson collection, with 28 sculptures, 8 drawings, and 3 dry points, has a wide range. All the different materials of sculpture, clay, plaster, bronze, and marble, are represented by fine examples that give a special breeze to the whole collection. The most important of Rodin's sculptures are present directly or indirectly. Alongside with the Kiss, the Thinker, and the Walking Man, the Simpsons had bought fine, small-scale bronze casts of the Age of Bronze, the Burger of Calais, and also a study for Balzac's head, as if to commemorate these major monuments of the Burgers of Calais and to Balzac, on which Rodin had worked for a decade and which are so important in his œuvre. In 1906, they set their minds on 2 marbles, a group of children, which was intended as a present to Jean, if we trust the inscription, and Mourning, one of the very essential sculptures Rodin was famous for. The 2 marbles arrived with the Byzantine Empress St. George in November 06, and they were installed in Kate's boudoir. In December, she wrote to Rodin, "Each day, I have a new impression of my beautiful marbles. You cannot possibly know the joy I have in owning them. I find the bronze bust of St. George so beautiful and strong, and the 2 marbles, Mourning and Love and Friendship, are beautifully placed in my beautiful Louis XV boudoir. When you come to see me in April, I'm sure you will find these beautiful things well placed." Of course, Rodin never went into the States. But I suggest we linger on the 3rd marble, Fleeting Love, which will allow me to explain Rodin's process. It is also a good example of the extreme freedom which a sculptor enjoyed in his studio, plaster being a material that allows an artist to do anything. Fleeting Love, or rather, Young Mother in the Grotto, which is the point of departure of the composition, appears in the upper part of the left pilaster of the Gates of Hell, in a version of the Gates, which is only known through this 1887 photograph. This charming group of a young mother and her child was soon taken off the gates because the image of maternal love didn't fit the tragic depiction of hell. But it was valued by collectors, and Rodin had the composition translated into marble at least 3 times, one of these marbles being currently in Philadelphia. Rodin didn't stop at there. He turned the group back to front, replaced the baby by another one, and again had the group carved in marble. The location of the first version isn't known, but we know how it looked through plaster and bronze casts, which you can see on the screen. A second version was bought by Major Higginson, who had a smaller but fine collection in Boston, and the Simpsons got the 3rd copy at roughly the same time. The 3 versions are different. For Rodin, every marble is a unique sculpture, depending on the shape and volume of the marble block, depending also on the carver, on the remarks people could make, on the accidents which could happen. To Mrs. Simpson's eyes, the most important of the marbles was Evil Spirit, a marble about which not much is known. By 1900, Rodin had plenty of assistants, And we could almost say that from that point on, he no longer touched the sculpture. He proceeded only by assemblage, sticking forms together, which he had modeled much earlier when he was creating the Gates of Hell. Some of the assemblage were translated into marble, but we cannot understand why it chose one over another. I like to compare these two groups. Both of them have been built with three figures, with one of them laid on the top of the others. One of the group, the one on the left, never left the privacy of the studio, while the other one was selected for a marble carving. And however, the process is the same, since Rodin was driven by the forms themselves and never by an idea or a subject. Inventing a title always was the last step. Titles that are always inspired by the symbolist taste that was so pregnant at the turn of the century. The groups met with success, and for instance, we know at least three marbles of the Evil Spirits. They differ in the carving of the base, as you can see here, and also in the way the legs in the back are or are not detached from the base. The bronze on the left being cast from a mold taken on the first marble. Bronzes and marbles were intended to be sold, and indeed the Simpsons bought them at a rate for friends, from a friend to a friend, in Kate's words, as a September 1906 invoice proves. At that time, Rodin sent two different marble copies of Mourning, and the one intended for James Inglis, who was one of the Simpsons' friends, was 500 francs more expensive than the Simpson one. And in 1908, when Kate asked Rodin to send her the bill for the copy of The Age of Bronze that she had commissioned for the Metropolitan Museum, he answered, "It's up to you to set a price that is noticeably lower than what I usually ask in recognition of our friendship, and please do not hurry." But still more unusual, the Simpsons were always able to get terracottas and plasters. Rodin did not like to part with the plasters, as he was always afraid that they could give birth to bronze casts that would fall outside his control. Anyhow, he gave them studies for hands and feet, as he sometimes did for people he liked. He also let them have two clay sketches, Eve eating an apple and a statuette of a woman, that had served as the starting points for a long, laborious process that extended throughout his career. Leading to two of his last important works that help usher in the 20th century sculpture, they illuminate his approach from studies from living models to forms that encapsulate the essence of the sculpture. One of this series of variations, currently exhibited in Paris Grand Palais for Rodin Centenary Show, morphs the small Eve on the right into a torso, which is a derivation so simplified that it has become an almost abstract form. But the series generated by the statuette is just as interesting. Its arch silhouette was a seed which led almost 30 years later to the life-size torso of a young woman with an arched back exhibited at the Salon of 1910. A complete and standing figure, obviously modeled from scratch from one of the young women who used to sit for Rodin, the terracotta is a vigorous sketch quickly done, especially in the head, where only the essential volumes are indicated, whereas the torso is more refined. The surface is imprinted with the marks of a special tool, a kind of rasp with thin teeth, and it is still fixed on a wooden base, characteristic of Rodin's studio. At one point, Rodin eliminated the head, the arms and legs to obtain a torso. He then enlarged it, as was customary with his main sculptures in the beginning of 20th century. The link between all these forms is evidenced by the thin like protrusions visible on the torso's hips, left when the artist removed the arms and hands from the terracotta. Rodin also simplified the surface, and even if some critics protested against his apparent new habit of systematically exhibiting only studies of details, the beauty of the enlarged torso was recognized at the Salon of 1910, and the Ministry of Fine Arts commissioned a first bronze cast for the Musée du Luxembourg in Paris. Embellished with a pale green patina, the bronze torso of a young woman with arched back is one of the works, including The Walking Man, in which Rodin comes closest to the antiquity he admired so much. In 1908, Rodin gave the Simpsons a bust of a young woman. It bears on the back the inscription, "Given to Madame and Monsieur Simpson, 1908, original terracotta made in 1875. The inscription was added by Rodin on Kate's request. She wrote, "Will you sign my bust, dear master, before it is packed?" We can imagine that the Simpsons took notice of the bust, which belonged to Rodin's early period when they visited him during the summer. But it was probably in poor condition and had to be restored first. And indeed, a technical examination has confirmed that plaster has been added to the clay. And then the whole sculpture covered with a red browed patina to give it a more unified appearance. But what is more puzzling is the date, 1875, that Rodin inscribed on the back. Indeed, a quick note written down in 1942 records a conversation with Kate Simpson. Rodin would have told her that he did this bust while Carpo was working on the dance for the Paris Opera, that is, in 1868-69. Of course, we cannot be surprised that 40 years later, Rodin didn't remember the exact date of the bust, and actually, it's more similar to works he did when he was in Caribelle's workshop before 1870. Adding flowers and ribbons modeled in the wet clay to a stamped face was a technique characteristic of Caribelle's work. Fall after fall, the Simpsons went to Paris. In fact, they resided in Versailles and went to Paris by car. In 1908, Kate announced her visit to Rodin's studio in Paris, saying they would arrive around 3:30 because maybe we shall be driving. They spent time with Rodin. "What delightful days I have had with you, she writes, for instance, or "A beautiful memory that will last forever. Can you come for lunch with us on Thursday? We can visit the Louis XV apartments before lunch and the Little Trianon Theater after. The sun will shine and I'm sure we shall have a wonderful time." Kate's letters give a sense of how free their relationship was. "Make me a little drawing of the cathedral and send it to me. That would be so pleasant for me," she asked when Rodin was visiting the French countryside. Some of the sculptures and drawings bear beautiful dedications, which are the best tokens of their strong friendship. Visit of Monsieur and Madame Simpson, September 25, 1904, Meudon. Or Homage to Mrs. Simpson, October 11, 1905. Homage to Mrs. Kate Simpson, 1907. Or In Memory of Paris, 1907, to Monsieur John Simpson from New York in great sympathy. Our drawing made this morning, July the 7th, 1908, and dedicated to my friend John Woodruff Simpson, and the same day to his friend, the eminent lawyer John Woodruff Simpson, July the 7th, 1908. And the last, but perhaps the most beautiful one, to Mrs. Simpson, friend of my heart from the first hour, 1909. The last of these Rodin's gifts bears the date of 1909. After that year, the correspondence shows that Kate's principal aim had shifted from a personal collection to that of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She had already convinced one of her sisters, Mrs. Robinson, to buy a drawing and a sculpture at the exhibition organized by Edward Steichen and Alfred Stieglitz, which opened in January 1908 at the Photo Secession Gallery in New York. I have a great satisfaction here in New York in being able to see the exhibition of your drawings, she writes to Rodin. They are so beautiful, and my sister, Mrs. Robinson, bought two of them, La Serpentine and L'Homme qui Marche. Both shine with beauty and strength. Every so often, I admire the ones that I own, and I never forget the gift that you have given me and how much gratitude I feel. In fact, if La Serpentine was a watercolor, probably inspired by Loy Fuller's Serpentine Dance, and probably in the National Gallery collection, since the name of Mrs. Robinson is inscribed on the back of this drawing, The Walking Man was certainly the bronze given to the Metropolitan Museum in 1940 by Louise Robinson, who was Mrs. Simpson's niece. The base of the sculpture bears the inscription, Rodin, happy to see his work, The Walking Man, in her lounge, offers her his friendly homage. From now on, and maybe under her late father's influence, Kate Simpson committed herself to developing Rodin's presence in the United States. She lent pieces of her collection as many times as she could to exhibitions, mainly in Boston or New York. The thinker is sitting like the guardian angel of the show at Stieglitz in 1910. But in 1914, she was both vexed and sorry to refuse the loan of her bust to the San Francisco Panama Pacific International Exposition. And she wrote to Rodin, I assure you that if it were a bronze, I would quickly send it. But with a marble, it's another matter completely. We do not have packers like those in Paris, but even worse is a railroad. For a load of that weight, you need a slow train, and that would take at least 2 or 3 weeks of travel with many changes along the way. Now, I hope, dear master, that you can understand why I am forced to cable you now. You know that my bust is one of the most precious things in my house, and that we cannot run such a risk. But she was mainly interested in making Rodin more present in the Met's permanent collection. Yesterday, I had a very interesting conversation at the museum on the subject of your work, she wrote. The director told me the museum is in the process of commissioning some works and that he wants to speak with my husband and myself. Rest assured that I shall do my best to see that the Museum of New York will have several of your marbles. How happy I will be to see you shown in a decent way in my country. She had begun by giving a full-size bronze copy of The Age of Bronze, which was, as she told Rodin, beautifully placed in the museum at the end of the staircase across from the entry. I am very satisfied, and I am sure that you would approve. At the same moment, Edward D. Adams gave a marble of The Hand of God. Rodin was aware of what he owed to Kate, and in February 1908, he sent her a beautiful letter. "Dearest friends, I always, your letter gives me such tender pleasure, your thoughts that I forget. Alas, my life is so terrible that I am always sick, though ready to get well again. I work too much, but if I do not do that, I don't know what to do and I get bored. But when I do relax, I think of you, who, by your goodness, has meant so much in my life. There is no word for women who encourage those in the arts. Men we call mécènes. You know how much I love your family, so noble and so affectionate, and after the admiration you have shown for my works, I need to be a friend whose friendship will bring us even closer together." The Metropolitan Museum of Art Rodin Galleries opened in May 1912, and in December, Kate assured the artist that it is very beautiful and very impressive. And then she went on helping as much as she could to enlarge the collection. On November 9, 1913, she was delighted to tell Rodin that she had succeeded in convincing one of her best friends, Watson Dickerman, to commission a bronze cast, and it was the first, of the large-scale martyr for the galleries. "Since I wrote you a letter an hour ago, one of my best friends came for dinner. During dinner, I explained the project of your bronze martyr to him, and suddenly he said, 'I shall give it to the museum.' I am delighted, and I immediately telephoned the director, who said that the museum is so happy to have the bronze. I told him that I thought would be the best location. It's a room next to the Rodin room with a sinker and 4 or 5 other works of yours. I am so delighted, so happy to see another work of yours in our museum and to have caused it to happen." To show his gratitude, Rodin sent her his book, Les Cathédrales de France, just out in the spring of 1914. And she thanked him. "I never knew that you could also make architectural drawings. Dear Grand Maître, you can do everything. The work itself is beautiful, delightful, full of you. And I will keep it forever. Thank you 1,000 times. They were never to meet again, but it didn't prevent Kate from writing to Rodin from time to time, inquiring about the project of the Rodin Museum in Paris, worrying about his health, his works, the war. She still bought a bronze cast of the bust of the English poet and writer William Henley, which current location is unknown. The last letter she sent Rodin is dated February 20, 1917, a few days after Rose's death. I quote, "When we first met you, you led me to understand the debt you owed to your dear wife. You spoke to me of her help with your work, and with all the things for which you were indebted to her. With my own eyes, I saw her devotion to you. If you have enough strength, send me a few words telling me that your health is good and that you are not too sad. I really miss not being in France at this moment. Perhaps if I was with you, I could help you in some way." Rodin died in November of the same year, 1917. John Simpson died in 1920. In the spring of 21, Kate returned to France. She visited Meudon, which had been Rodin's actual residence and where he died, and she found the home in a very bad state. She immediately gave the director of the Musée Rodin, Léonce Bénédite, a check to begin the clean-up, and she wished to support the restoration of the house and furniture. For an unknown reason, it seems that nothing happened, nothing was undertaken in Meudon until the second half of the 20s, when Jules Masbaum made up his mind to create a Rodin Museum in Philadelphia, which permitted Meudon restoration. In New York, in the meanwhile, Kate was always willing to show her collection to anybody who enjoyed visiting that place of elegance and harmony, where Ecole de Barbizon and 18th century French and English paintings were the companions of Rodin sculpture. Her bust was in the reception room. Another room was devoted to Fragonard, represented by 6 paintings. In a third room, The Sinker, The Edge of Bronze, The Walking Man, and The Small Burger of Calais were together with Reburn, Binning Boys, Chardin, The Bubbles, and the portrait of a young boy by Goya. I quote, "There is in New York a house which is saturated with French atmosphere, for not alone an excellent example of Decamps, Rousseau, Corot, and of the sculptor Rodin, greet one from the threshold, but it holds a collection of works of very high quality by some of the most original and characteristic masters of 18th century France," writes Jules Giffray, who was an art historian. Soon after 1940, Kate decided to retire in East Craftsbury, Vermont, the place where The Simpsons came from, and she began to think about what to do with the collection. She intended first to give the Met the 2 most important sculptures, her bust and the Evil Spirits. However, since the Met had already The Age of Bronze, A Sinker, and her sister Walking Man, it was not interested in the whole collection. But it happened that the National Gallery of Art in Washington had just opened with large empty galleries. And Mrs. Simpson quickly decided to give the new museum a Rodin collection, sculptures, drawings, and dry points. I quote, "The quality of the bronzes and marbles is absolutely first rate as far as finished is concerned. The terracottas are unusually early in date and are extremely rare. The provenance of the collection, coming as it does from the artist through Mrs. Simpson, could not be improved. This is an opportunity which will not turn up again," said Charles Seymour, in charge of the sculpture, to the acquisition committee on April 21st, 1942. "Her change of art was a major coup for the gallery," said Monsieur Dickerson. She also gave some of the 18th century paintings that her husband had collected. The Philadelphia Rodin Museum, which opened in 1929, or the Spreckle Collection, on loan to San Francisco the Legend of Honor since 1924, are larger and perhaps more impressive collections. But that of the Simpson had a very special quality, as Seymour had remarked. It came directly from Rodin and contained works which are among the most perfect in the huge range of the artist's oeuvre, maybe because they reflect the personal link the artist and the collectors had woven. Having raised the National Gallery to the first tier of Rodin's collection, the Simpson's gift attracted other donations. Agnes Meyer, who had her portrait made by Brancusi, gave the beautiful marble sphinx in 1967, and this was followed by the counter gifts, including a plaster study for the portrait of Lady Sackville, another woman with whom, at the very end of his career, Rodin had been able to build a strong relation. Her portrait can be seen as a response to Kate Simpson's bust. Thank you very much. And now, if there are some questions, I'll be happy to answer. Yes?
Well, maybe this is a complicated question, but just simply, like, there's so many techniques involved. There's the marble, and then there's bronze, and there's the plaster, and just so very simply, did he work in clay and then from clay make plaster casts? And then from there, what's the process of making marble? And I guess I'm more familiar with the bronze process, but I don't understand how we get from plaster to marble. Did he then
Thank you, Sarah, for this question. So Rodin, of course, first modeled the clay. All the sculptors did the same. When he was happy with the clay, a plaster cast was taken on that clay. And then most of the sculptors had just one plaster cast, but since Rodin had plenty of assistants, he used to have not one, but perhaps 5 or 10 or 15 plaster casts. And then the plaster cast stayed in the studio. And after a while, perhaps 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, Rodin just rediscovered these little figures, and he used to take two of them, chosen just by chance, and to stick them together to create a new group. And, you know, so he worked in clay, but he also worked with plaster, which is perhaps different from what the other sculptors used to do. And then, when a plaster was chosen, for a reason which is very difficult to find, to recognize, he gave the plaster to one of his assistants, to one of the carver who were around him, and then it was this man, which was most of the time a young sculptor, who needed to earn his living. So he gave the plaster to one of his assistants, and this assistant transferred the composition from plaster to marble with what we called le système des points. It's a kind of compass which take measure on the plaster and then reports them on the marble. But Rodin didn't carve himself. From the beginning of his career, he had decided that it was a very exhausting and boring work, so he had other people to do it for him. But Rodin was very looked after the carving process. You know, he just didn't give the plaster to the carvers and came 3 months later. I think he was in a daily contact, daily relation with the carver, and he told him, here you go a little further, here you can leave it as it is, and today it's perfect. So there was a control by Rodin on the carver work.
I meant to say at the beginning of my question, that was a superb lecture. Thank you.
Yes?
Thanks so much for that. I was impressed by all the correspondence between Simpson and Rodin. And I was wondering if you could comment on how good was her French? And was it very typical of American collectors of Rodin to be so fluent in French?
I have to say that the correspondence is in French, with sometimes awkward expressions, which is not really surprising. And it had been translated by Rose Butler when she wrote the entries for the National Gallery Systematic Catalogue, and I have used most of the times, and I have used her translation. But yes, Kate Simpson spoke French quite fluently when Rodin was unable to say a word in English. Rodin couldn't speak English, and so he wrote in French, and she answered in French. And I'm just giving a look at the letters of Elizabeth Cameron, who was another American lady, who was Rodin's friend, and who was an intermediary for commissions more from the Boston side of the States. And she also writes in French, and Rodin answers in French. But I like the correspondence because I think it gives an impression of a close and not conformist, pas conformist du tout friendship between them, which is quite unusual. The question of Camille Claudel is a complex one. Of course, Camille Claudel has profited from, is a tragic fate, and most of the people are interested in Camille because they know that she spent 30 years of her life in an asylum. But it was a very strong relation between the two of them, and the two of them suffered a loss when they separated. Alors, Camille was about, I think she was 24 years younger than Rodin. She arrived in Paris when she was very young, and she went in Rodin's studio just to learn more about sculpture. And of course, in the studio, there were exchanges. Alors, and I am sure, we know that they talked a lot, and that Camille had always been very close to Rodin. And when we look at the works, we can see that you had kind of influences going from one of them to the other one, and then back to the first. It's very interesting. But I know perfectly well that it is said sometimes that Camille has done some of Rodin's work, and I cannot hear that, because you know Camille's work is a quite small work when Rodin's work is huge. And also, she was in the studio and she was supposed to collaborate to Rodin's works. It's almost the same question than with the carvers. The carvers, when they did Rodin marbles, were working as if they were Rodin. And if Camille modeled some hands or feet for the gates of hell, as we know, as has been told, she did it for Rodin and under his name. So it's difficult, and it's also difficult because all this happened in the privacy of the studio, and we have no record of that. So we can just look at the works of art and sometimes say, yes, here I can think that Rodin perhaps has been influenced by Camille Claudel, but it only happens in one or two cases. And it's also interesting, I think, when you look it through the relation, because Rodin was in love with her, but he also admired her as an artist. And it's nice to see how those things were intricated one in the other. I'm not sure I'm very clear.
So Rodin himself was a great carver as well.
Rodin was, no, he was not.
Was he a great carver?
No, he was not a great carver because Rodin has a very personal approach to marble, because he liked to leave the marble block as natural as it was. But he himself didn't touch the marble
at all.
From the 1870s, as soon as he had just a very little, very small budget, he asked somebody else to carve his marble. It's very clear. Yes, yeah, but Camille carved at least some of the marble. Yes,
she.
And perhaps you have seen the Sacha Guitry film with when you can see Rodin in front of a marble bust, and you see Rodin chiseling the marble and the little bits of marble just jumping out from the block, and it's movie. It's not reality. It was done because the image of the sculptor since Michelangelo is to be in front of the block and just to attack the block himself with his chisel and hammer. But I think from the beginning of 17th century, it was totally finished in France, and I think also in Italy. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.